sometimes we'll get going, I suppose, with some of the fresh insight. So we'll just fire away and see what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn, thank you for all the Dhamma talks. I have all 40 kayas, but I find it quite hard to read them. Can you kindly point me to a sutta that is easy to read and understand and help me start reading? Thank you. Yes, this is often a problem for people that they find it a bit difficult. And part of the responsibility, I think, of a translator is to present the Dhamma in an understandable way. And I think this is maybe one of the problems with somebody like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, is that he's a philosopher, he has a PhD in philosophy, and he thinks like a philosopher, so he often uses language which is not very easy to understand. This is a problem. I think at the time of the Buddha, the way the Buddha taught, he taught ordinary people, he would have used ordinary language, right? And I think we should be doing the same thing in the present day. We should translate in a way whereby it's easy to understand. And I think sometimes we don't live up to that kind of standard. So one thing to do is to look at some of the new translations coming out now. There is my colleague Ajahn Sujato is doing a full translation of all the four Nikayas. And they haven't been released yet, but they will soon be available on the internet. This will all be internet-based, which actually is very good. Instead of having to buy books, all the other religions have their religious books on the internet, except Buddhism. We're kind of one of the few where it isn't really fully available. It's really, really bad. So we have to get going with that. That's going to probably be released, maybe. That might take another year or so before it's released, but then it should be available. Hopefully, that should be a little bit easier. But in the meantime, what you might want to do is to... there's a number of things that you can do to ease that. One of them is, of course, to listen to the sutta talks that are given that we do in places like the BSWA. And a lot of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, the vast majority, have been explained there, right? So you can listen to the explanation while you read it. It can be very useful and very powerful to do that. Sometimes you read it first for yourself, and then afterwards you check it out. Another way of doing it is to start with books like In the Buddha's Words, a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi again. But this is, in this case, it is kind of selected, it's kind of put into chapters according to topics, and also very well explained, so it's much easier to understand in that particular case. That's In the Buddha's Word, which is like an anthology. Apart from that, what I would recommend you to do when you read, if there's a sutta that is too difficult and hard to understand, one of the problems with the Majjhima Nikaya, if you start with, I love the Majjhima Nikaya, such a beautiful collection, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, really, really nice suttas with a bit of story around what the Buddha was doing, and quite long and substantial discourses. But unfortunately, the whole collection starts with one of the most difficult suttas that is around, right? So straight away, you read two paragraphs, and you think, oh, too much, can't do this, and you put it away, you never open it again. This is the kind of thing that happens, right? So what I recommend you to do, if you have the Majjhima Nikaya, or you have any of the Nikayas, is to just start reading. If you don't enjoy it, put it away. Don't read it. Well, not don't put it away, but skip a few suttas, right? And then go to a sutta that you actually like. Yeah? And this is really one of the best ways of doing it. So just read the stuff that makes sense to you. Some of the things that I've been reading out here is taken from those Nikayas, and I'm sure you will have understood what that is basically about, like the gradual training, that kind of thing. Is actually quite straightforward. There are also parts of the suttas, like if you go to the Samyutta Nikaya, there are parts of that that are quite nice, simple little stories, simple teachings. Like, for example, in the Kosala Samyutta, all the discussions between the Buddha and King Pasenadi, they're often very nice and quite simple. That was the simile of the mountain I was reading out the other day, right? The mountains coming from the four directions. That was from the Kosala Samyutta, the third Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. So just skip things, right? Don't feel like you have to read from cover to cover. There's absolutely no reason. Once it's not like a novel, right? You don't have to go from cover to cover. Just enjoy whatever you like. Whatever you like, just enjoy that and forget about everything else. Try some of those things and see what happens. Okay. Okay, with regards to the five kinds of people, sometimes when we praise and see the positive side of the not so good person, the weeds in the pond grow even more. Okay, swell-headed even more, in other words. In other words, the person becomes meaner instead of a better person towards you. Okay, so remember that when we not necessarily have to praise them so much, right? Don't say, oh, you're such a wonderful person, you are just really great. That's not really the point here. This is a personal thing. You see the good sides, right? The other person may have bad sides as well, so you just leave them, let them be whoever they are. You just act in a normal way, practice the Buddhist way. You are still kind towards them, of course, but you don't have to praise them for those sides. Just see them so that you don't get upset and you don't get angry. This is mostly about your own practice, right? So in that case, if they really react in such a bad way, then just let it be, yeah? And don't sort of pursue something if it causes problems for you now. Instead of a better person towards you, what did we do wrong here? Or can we change tack? Thank you, Adam. I really learned and enjoyed the retreat with you. I'll be back. Okay, that's really good. Okay, great. So I hope that makes sense. Make it into a personal thing. But always remember, I think this is so, I've always found that in my life, that kindness is so powerful. If you're just kind to people, you don't have to praise them over the top. That is not necessarily kindness anyway, but just kindness in your actions and just speaking in a soft and friendly way without necessarily making them, you know, boost their ego or whatever. That usually works with most people anyway. Yeah. Okay. Oh, put me down, this one says. Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm not sure what that this is supposed to mean. Somebody is. Okay, put you down. I can't do that personally, you know. That's against my precepts if I put you down. So, anyway, so, yeah, there you are. Okay, maybe you were a dog in the fast line, and you kind of carrying on with the dog habit of being put down. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmavi, thank you for these Q&A sessions, which have been very helpful for my development. Question: contentment. Yesterday you mentioned the need to feel content with what we have. How to apply this? I believe that one should challenge oneself for continuous growth. If I'm easily contented, wouldn't I end up just being a couch potato? Thank you for sharing your wisdom. It depends what you are contented with, right? There are certain things that you should be contented with, other things that you should not be so contented with. If you have lots of ill will, you should not be contented with your ill will, right? Oh, ill will, content, okay, no problem. That is a wrong kind of contentment. What I mean by contentment is contentment with the worldly things. You can divide life into the worldly things and the spiritual things. So the spiritual things we try to grow, and the worldly things basically you try to be content. You try not to kind of, okay, my car is too small, I'd like to have a bigger car, the neighbor has a big car, I need to have a big car too, that kind of stuff, right? My social position is not really high enough, I'd like to climb the social ladder a bit more, or whatever it is, you know, all this kind of worldly stuff, right? That is where you are content, because that there is no end to that pursuit, and it doesn't matter if you get a bigger car, it doesn't matter if you become the ruler of the whole world, you're still not going to be content, and this is part of the problem. So instead, you look at yourself, but it's also important, even in the spiritual practice, not to be too fault-finding, right? Oh, I am not good, I have to be much better, you know, than I am already. You should be glad that you have the good qualities that you have. Everybody here has lots of good qualities. And we should rejoice in the fact that we're already doing good things and doing the right way. If you always look towards the future, what you can change, how you can become better, then you're not really rejoicing in what you have already done. I always find it very encouraging when I look back on my life and I see you know, how far I've gone, right, from the early days to now, and I think, wow, this is great. That is often very encouraging when you see the change, rather than always focusing on what is still left to be done. Right? So, finding that middle way somewhere is actually very useful. So then when you kind of rejoice in the goodness and the things you're doing right, it also encourages you to actually do more good as a consequence as well. Because you see that it works, right? When these teachings work and when you see that for yourself, that's when they really come to life for you. So don't be a couch potato. Don't just kind of chill and, you know, kind of lay back, oh yeah, you know, desires, anger, what you expect. That is not really quite the right way either. So find that nice middle path of that, and then you'll be fine. Okay, dear madam, what is pure land? Is our goal to go to the pure land versus good rebirth? Thank you. Oh, okay. You've got a lot of pure land questions this week. I've never seen so many pure land questions in my entire life. So this is a special pure land retreat. Okay. So, is our goal to go to the pure land? Your goal is to progress as much as you can in the Dhamma, right? And then you allow the rebirth to take care of itself. You know, if you make maximum progress, your rebirth is going to be the best possible afterwards. Should you have a goal to go to, don't have any goals about where you go afterwards. Just kind of focus on the here and now. Focus on what you're doing. Make the most out of the present moment. How can I be kind in this very moment? Right? That should really be the goal, if you like. That's what you should be pursuing. And then all this other stuff, that kind of happens by itself. So don't worry so much about this. Right? Really, when we talk about Buddhism, we don't talk so much about pure land. In early Buddhism, we talk more about attaining Nibbana, right? Which is the ending of all suffering. If you go to the pure land, you're still going to suffer, right? Because the pure land isn't quite as pure as the name would have it. It's still not perfect. There's still some suffering there, even though it sounds like it is great. Wherever you are, wherever you exist, you always bring some of the problems with you. So you make an end of everything. That's kind of the Buddhist idea. End of all suffering. No more rebirth. Going to the pure land is also a kind of rebirth in a way. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in Singapore, when we die, our body has to be cremated as there are no more new burial grounds. Most people have their ashes put in urns in the temples. I don't wish to do this and have my children with a burden of visiting my urn, okay? Can I just have my ashes thrown in the air? Because even throwing in the sea requires special government permits. Will I become a wandering ghost? Thank you. Okay, well, you can do whatever you like, right? These ashes, once you are dead, they are just ashes. They are just like ashes anywhere. One nice thing that we do at Bodhinyana Monastery sometimes, we put them at the roots of trees, because ash apparently is a very good fertilizer here. So you put it with the trees and you help the trees grow, right? This is a great way of ending your life. It's the last kind of good act of merit by helping nature out in such a way. I probably can't do it in Singapore, because Singapore, I'm sure, is ultra-regulated about all these kind of things. I know it's Singapore. It's a small city, so you have to regulate quite a lot, right? It makes sense. But at Bodhinyana Monastery, sometimes we just throw the ashes out, right, on the ground somewhere. People are very happy with that. You can do whatever you like with the ashes. And it doesn't mean you become a ghost if you throw it into the air, right? This is just the mortal remains. It's got nothing to do with your mind and where you go afterwards. So ashes, do whatever you want. Sometimes, you know, if you have your urn somewhere and your children have it, it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be a burden to your children. If you have been a good Buddhist, right, and your kids and your grandchildren, they look at that and think, wow, that was our grandmother, grandfather, right? They were really good people. Maybe they have some good memories of you. Maybe you inspire them to live a good life, right? It isn't necessarily bad. And when your children, that make some merit in your name and they transfer it to you,
they get some happiness as well, right?
So if they are wise children and wise grandchildren, they may gain some benefit of having your ashes, even just in the house, in their apartment, might actually be a good thing. So don't think, you know, these things are often complicated, and it's not one-sided. Okay. Is it true that the person who is beautiful, handsome, is because he or she has accumulated a good karma, morality specifically in the past? Possibly, maybe that might very well be part of it. That you know, you create good karma and then that actually comes out and you has an effect on your appearance. That's probably quite possibly the case. Actually, it says so in the sutta specifically that is the case. So if you make good karma, it will have a good result in that way. But, you know, it's always a danger, right? Once you start thinking like this, you think, oh yeah, I better make some good karma so I become beautiful in the future. But really, it's such a small thing, right? And sometimes you become beautiful, you become really conceited because of that. It can have so many downsides as well. So I would just allow karma to take its course. Do what is good because it makes you happy rather than kind of what it gives you possibly in the future. Conversely, if a person has a defect, for example, blindness or deafness, it is due to accumulated bad karma from previous lives, Maybe, maybe not, right? Can sometimes be. But it may just be the accidents of life. Life is always uncertain, and sometimes people go blind just because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. I understand there is no specific formula, but in general, how long does it take for bad karma to be transformed to good karma, e.g. many lives, or can it be instantaneous? So bad karma doesn't, unfortunately, bad karma does not transform into good karma. We can't do that. Right? That's not how the Buddhist teachings work. If you have made bad karma, and they are going to, you're going to have to experience the result of that bad karma at least to some extent. Right? So what we have to do instead of transforming bad karma into good karma, what we have to do, there's another teaching of the Buddha which is very useful in this regard. This is known as the simile of the salt, of the grain of salt. Found in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, I think it's Sutta number 100 or something like that, Lona Pala Sutta in Pali. And in this Sutta, the Buddha says that if you imagine that your bad karma is like a grain of salt, right, or a little pinch of salt, or whatever you want to call it, that is your bad karma. And if you take that bad karma and you put it in a glass of water, right, the glass of water becomes incredibly salty. The glass of water, the amount of water, signifies your good karma. So if your good karma is small compared to your bad karma is relatively large, the result is very, very salty, very unpleasant. But instead, if you have a big pond of water, or even the river Ganges, right, the river Ganges is what is used in the simile, and you put the same amount of salt in this big pond, or in the river Ganges, you can barely taste it at all, if at all. So exactly the same amount of bad karma, the same kind of lump of salt, but this time the good karma is enormous. And because of that, it dilutes the effect of the bad karma. So you may still experience it, but you will experience it in a very, very slight way. But this is what we have to do. So don't worry. If you have made some bad karma in this life, it is not such a big deal. What your job now is to do is to maximize your good karma. That is what you should be doing. And by doing that, you are kind of gradually, the bad karma just recedes into the background, disappears, and it isn't so important anymore. So this is the right attitude to this. So don't, you know, you made some bad karma, okay, everybody has made some bad karma. Don't worry too much about that. Now practice the path in the right way, and you will be okay. How do you know that you are making good karma in this life? And the main way you know that is that you feel good about your actions. Don't just make good karma blindly, right? Some of us say, yeah, okay, I'm going to do this and do that. See if it works. How does it make you feel, right? This is the most important thing here. If it makes you feel good and you get some instantaneous good karma by how you feel, then you know that you're doing the right thing. This idea about good karma experienceable in this very life, right here and right now. It's such an important part of it. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And okay, what is the difference in focus between the greater and the shorter discourse of the elephant's footprint? Okay, so the fact that one is called, the fact that they're both called the elephant's footprint, one is called the long one, the other one the short one, doesn't actually mean anything. Those two suttas have very little in common. They're almost completed. They're very, very different topics. The shorter discourse that I've been reading out is all about the gradual training, and I think for that reason it's a very, very beautiful training that is applicable to everyone. The longer discourse of the elephant's footprint is all about the four elements. Right? In Buddhism, we have this idea of dividing up material existence into elements. So we have the earth element, which is like hardness, right? You have the water element, anything liquid, the air element, and then you have the heat element, which is, basically whatever it has in the temperature, that's where the heat element comes in. And it's not the idea of that, it's not to describe the world. This is what the world is, right? Four elements contra the periodic table, which one is right. It's not about that at all. The Buddhist idea of elements is much more a practical way of understanding the material world. Right? It's a very easy way of understanding it, because these are aspects of materiality. So that is what that is about. And we can think of our body, and we can think of the external world in terms of elements. Just to take away some of this idea of possessiveness. This is my body. If you think of your body in terms of elements, it becomes very impersonal. You don't take your body so seriously anymore. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Dan, sometimes I am invited for corporate dinners where live seafood is killed, sometimes in a ceremonious way, in front of us, to prove its freshness. What is the best way to keep the precept of not killing? I end up not eating, but this invites a lot of questions from colleagues. I do not wish to explain, as they may not understand, but I do not wish to lie as well. What should I do? Okay, well, in these kind of cases, I'm not sure exactly how this works, but if the food is killed, you obviously don't have any intention for the food to be killed anyway. This is something that happens because you happen to be in that place. And what is the most important thing is that your intention in this particular case. So if the food happens to be killed in front of you, it is not your fault. And then if you eat it afterwards, it's not really a problem. Right, it's not a big deal. It's only if you specifically go and say, "Yo, kill that one, right? That's when it's bad, right? Because you are actually asking for certain animals to be killed. But just because it happens in front of you is not such a bad thing. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. And if you want to eat some of that, it's not a big issue. It's not a big problem. But another way of doing it is to become a vegetarian, right? And say, "I'm a vegetarian." Oh, okay, so, and then usually people are fine with that, because there are so many vegetarians around the world these days, so people are often fine with that. And being a vegetarian is actually quite good. I'm mostly a vegetarian myself. I don't insist on it. If people give me meat, that's okay. But generally speaking, I tend to be vegetarian. And actually, it's quite nice to be vegetarian. I feel quite healthy and quite good about it. Sometimes you also feel that you are not supporting this meat industry, that kind of stuff, which is bad in many ways. Lots of greenhouse gases apparently from that industry, and lots of terrible treatment of animals. It's not very nice to support that, I feel. So personally, I've come around to the idea that being mostly vegetarian is actually a nice way of living. Yeah. It's not compulsory for a Buddhist, and it's really up to you what you want to do. But it can be a nice way of living. Yeah. Okay. Hey, Adam, can a layman like me, especially like you, right? That is the question here. Decide not to be reborn in my next life. Okay. Do I need to practice meditation, reach Dhamma Dasana, reach enlightenment and not be reborn again? Or is there another way to stop rebirth? Or everything is predestined and I cannot decide and go through the suffering of life and rebirth? Thank you. So is there another way, right? Is there another path, the Eightfold Path? Oh, so hard, the Eightfold Path, you know, too much. I want to find the easy way. Maybe maybe some of these later teachings, right, that were taught by others, maybe they are faster. Christianity, perhaps, right? Really, really fast. All you do is believe. And you are done. Right? That was one of the... my father told me this story. He said that because my father was a businessman, he was traveling a lot in Asia. When he was still a businessman, he hasn't worked for, I don't know, 30 years something now, but and he said that he was once, he went to Malaysia once, he was all over Asia basically, and he was sitting next to this lady, this businesswoman, and she told him that she had converted to Christianity. So my father asked her, why did you convert? She was of Chinese background, and she asked her, why did you convert? Oh, he said, there's much better deal than Christianity here. Right? You just have to believe. Don't have to work so hard for it. Not a better deal. But remember that if the deal is too good, right? Just like in business, if the deal is too good, it might not be the real thing. You might actually end up being... You have to be careful in business life. And the same thing, you have to be careful in the spiritual life as well. Sometimes it's too good to believe. But then it's better not to believe. So... can you decide? You cannot just decide not to be reborn. You have to practice the whole meditation, the whole path. Because the point of all of this is to end those defilements that give rise to rebirth. Those defilements can only end through insight, through understanding, through seeing non-self. You have to see things like non-self. You have to have some kind of profound seeing of reality. Otherwise, there's no way that rebirth can be ended. That is just what the Buddha taught. And if you hear about some other fast way, I would recommend you to be very, very skeptical about the other fast ways, even though it is very tempting to go for the fast way. Is everything predestined? It's up to whatever you do, right? If you live your life well, that will enhance your ability to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's really up to you to practice in the right way here. And what you do matters enormously on how the path develops. Okay. During meditation, angry thoughts of the past consume me. How do I let go when justice was not served? How do I let go if I still have to face this problem at work every day? Thank you. Okay. Ooh, okay. So, the thing is that justice is never served, right? Don't wait for justice. If you wait for justice, you will never get out of this samsaric existence. You will keep on going around forever because justice just doesn't happen there. And justice is a different thing in the eye, depends on the eye of the person. Some people see justice one way, some see another way. We all have our personal ideas of what justice is in a particular situation, right? We all look at every situation slightly differently. So don't wait for justice. Remember, this is the human realm. Things are uncertain, things are always changing. Sometimes people blame you for things you haven't done. Sometimes they praise you for things you haven't done, right? It's all very uncertain. But one of the things that you will find out is that the more pure-hearted you are as a person, the less often you will feel this way. And the less, more often, people will treat you in a very nice and kind way. So just practice in the right way. And then gradually things tend to disappear into the background as a consequence. So, the way to let go of the past if justice hasn't been served is all the things I was talking about before today, about just understanding that people are people. People do bad things, stupid things, often against their better judgment. They want to be good. They want to do the right thing. They know in their heart that goodness is the same as happiness. Right? I think most people know that. They know that if they can do good, they will be happy. But still, they do bad things because they can't stop themselves. They are conditioned in a certain way. Have compassion for these people, right?
What a terrible thing it is if you want to do good, but you're not able to because of your conditioning here. So just by changing that perspective a little bit, then you're starting to have more compassion already here. Or imagine people who have grown up in the wrong way, in the wrong neighborhood, with the wrong people. Sometimes you hear about people growing up in a kind of mafia or in a triad family, right? And you are told to be criminal from the very beginning. And because we all want to please our families, we want to please society, it is very, very hard to extract yourself from that situation. Very, very difficult. And even though you may not be born into the mafia, still, we all have that, a little bit of that kind of conditioning in us to do what is bad from our peers, from our family, from society around us. And because of that, we sometimes do bad things as a consequence. So remember that if justice isn't served, have compassion. Have compassion for the victim, of course. Also have the compassion for the perpetrator, the person who is behind justice not being served. Have compassion for everybody. And when you start to open your heart to the world like that, you realize, yes, the world is full of suffering, justice will never be served, but at the very least, I can have compassion for people and help them out in my little way, by being kind, right? Saying a kind word here, a kind word there. If somebody is a victim and you are saying something kind to them, you will soothe some of the hurt in their life. But this is the right way of going about things. The world is uncontrollable. Don't wait for justice. Don't wait for the right leaders to be sworn into office, right? It's never going to happen. You know, there is no such thing as the perfect leader. Sometimes we get really bad leaders, right? And when we get that, remember that your real refuge is the Dhamma, it's not the world. And if you remember where your real refuge is, you will be fine. So, if you have this problem at work every day, that is not so nice, is it? That's not so good. So, what you have to do in that kind of situation is to learn to live well despite the work being difficult. You have to learn to be kind, you have to learn to let go of that situation, to deal with that situation in a good way. One of the great things, if things are difficult, is that you can actually learn very fast sometimes in a difficult situation. Right? We had all these children here before, some of them were a bit naughty, pulling the curtains, making noises. But instead of getting upset with that, you think, okay, how can I deal with this right here and right now in a positive way? How can I let go of that? And actually, you learn much more if you're able to let go of that straight away, rather than actually trying to solve the problem by asking the children to leave or something like that. You know, because you're actually learning to let go. You're learning to look at the world in a different way, and that is far more powerful. If work is really, really hard and it's just too difficult, then sometimes you just have to change your jobs. That's also okay. Right? So any of those solutions are fine. Hi, Anuramali. Could you please lead a metta meditation for us on this retreat? Thank you. So we'll do that. I'll put that to one side, so meant that tomorrow or the day after, and we'll do that. What do you think about the secular mindfulness movement, for example, Don Kabat-Zinn, etc.? Is it a helpful way to get folks to become interested in meditation as a Buddhist practice, or is this just another hot trend that will pass? Do you see any dangers with this trend of mindfulness being presented by laypersons, lay people? The thing about the Buddhist teachings is that they are often applicable in different kind of environments, applicable by different kind of people. And as long as people are gaining some benefit from these things, I think it's great. You know, if it makes people feel better, then it's wonderful. Sometimes people don't feel better, then it's not so good. But if they do feel better, then we're very happy to share our teachings in Buddhism with the world at large. Take whatever you like. If it helps you, it's wonderful. And some of those people, they might inquire about where this technique comes from, and perhaps it will lead them towards Buddhism. You know, it is possible. So by sharing what we have, some of those people might actually be led to a deeper understanding of the Buddhist teachings. Of course, one of the dangers of this kind of movement is that it is often not anchored in anything more profound, in anything real. It is just mindfulness without context. And mindfulness without context isn't going to take you very far. Mindfulness together with morality is incredibly powerful. If you lead a good life and you join the mindfulness training with that, boy, it becomes a very powerful thing. Mindfulness on its own, without having a very strong commitment to moral practice and kindness and these kind of things, is not going to take you very far. It may help a little bit, but not going to take you very far. That is one of the weaknesses of this kind of approach. I think slowly they are learning that, and they're kind of incorporating a bit more of virtue as well. But I think still it is lacking in its depth and its breadth and scope. Is it just another passing trend? Possibly, quite possibly it's a passing trend. Usually, you know, we live in a world full of trends all the time. Trends arise, trends pass away. One of the few long-term trends is like the suttas, right? The suttas are one of the long-term trends. They're going to pass very soon. So that's why that is quite a safe one. So I hope that answers the question reasonably well. So let's move on to the next one. Dear Adam, this morning you shared with us how to see the good qualities in a bad person and to show compassion to him or her. But is it easy for those Jews, victims' families, to show compassion to Hitler? That's a good question. One of the interesting stories there is that in our monastery in Perth we have connections with all kinds of people, and one of the persons who used to come to our monastery quite regularly, he was a rabbi in one of the Jewish Jewish place? Synagogue, that's right. He was a rabbi in one of the synagogues in Perth. And he would come to our monastery with the classes of children. He was also a teacher at one of the schools, I think, as well. He was doing a number of things. And he would come to our monastery. And he was one of these very liberal rabbis. And he said, of course, we should forgive Hitler, right? This was his message. Of course we should do that. And he was very completely at ease with forgiving Hitler from his point of view. And it's true, we should, right? It may not be easy if you are Jewish, especially if your family members were murdered and killed in the gas chambers and that sort of stuff. It may not be easy. But if you want a good life for yourself, forgiveness is really the only way to go. If you go around harboring negative thoughts and resentment, the only life you're making miserable is your own, right? This is one of the very good reasons to let go and forgive. Hitler was another conditioned person. He did these things because he was completely deluded, right? He had some good sides as well, actually, which is quite interesting. And he writes a letter to his mother that he wrote. It was a very kind of touching letter. So even Hitler, it seems, he loved his mother very much. So you can see, right? People have different sides. Nobody is completely evil. If you're completely evil, you wouldn't be able to exist in this world, essentially. And I have heard of many people who have forgiven complete things that are very hard to forgive. One example is, of course, Nelson Mandela, who was in prison for 20 years in South Africa, and he forgave completely. He came out, and he realized that if you harbor bad feelings about this, you're only destroying your own life. There was another lady who was living in Australia, who Adam Ram used to visit in prison, and she was from Eastern Europe, and she had been a dissident at the time when Eastern Europe was very staunchly communist, and she was put in jail, and she was in jail for 20 years or something in Eastern Europe, probably quite miserable actually. Maybe even chunky jail looks like kind of a plush place compared to some of these Eastern European jails, I'm not sure. I've actually been to Changi on a couple of heads. I know what it looks like. It's a quite scary place to go to. But anyway, she said, Adam Ram asked her, how does it feel? You know, are you upset? Do you feel resentment? Do you feel like, what do you feel about that? And she said, no, I have let go of all that. Because if I felt anger about that, if I felt resentful, it would be as if I let the other side win. Right? Because if you feel resentful, you are suffering because of that jail. If you don't feel resentful, you are free. their impact on your life was almost zero, and you can move on. Right? It was a very beautiful way of looking at things. In jail for 20 years, have done nothing wrong. All you have done is point out the badness of the regime, right? Showing how rotten the regime was. That's all you do. And still, no resentment afterwards. It's a wonderful example to all of us, how to live your life well. Not Buddhists even, right? These are just ordinary people who have a natural wisdom in them, and they understand how to live life in a good way. Number two. In the Buddha's time, he allowed women to be ordained and become nuns. Why Ajahn Brahm was prohibited to ordain nuns? That's a good question. And I have always found it quite interesting that, the Buddhist religion is one of the few religions where you had almost equality between the women and the men from the very beginning. Almost all other religions have been very kind of patriarchal, right? Men have been kind of in charge, and women have been very kind of, have really had very little say in the vast majority of religion. Buddhism is one of the very few ones, maybe the only big, probably the only big religion which has that sense of equality. And still somehow, now we are lagging behind other religions. Some of the, like the Norwegian church, I know this because I happen to be Norwegian. In the Norwegian church, right now at the top of the church is a woman at this moment, right at the very top. So you can see some of these religions which have no history of equality, they are now catching up with us and going beyond what Buddhism is doing here. So I think it is a kind of, if we are going to be taken seriously in the modern world, and I was very supportive of Ajahn Brahm of this whole thing, because I said to him, well, we want to be on the right side of history. The right side of history means to have that kind of equality. We're not going to be taken seriously unless we have that kind of equality. So that's why we went for that. But remember that the world generally doesn't like change. Right? Change, impermanence is a problem. We always suffer when there is impermanence around us. That is why impermanence is such a big thing in the Buddhist teachings. Right? So nobody likes change. Everybody is a resistance to change. So when women have been no nuns for 1,000 years in Theravada Buddhism, it's a lot to turn that around. It's very, very hard. And only a few pioneers will kind of have the guts, right, to actually go against the stream of everybody else. It's human nature that change is difficult. And I think that is basically the main reason. At the end of the day, there's no need to blame anyone. It's just that human nature is change is difficult. If we can avoid change, we'll avoid change at all costs. And this is what's happening in this case. So I don't think yet. So, there's no point in getting upset about these things. Like always, forgiveness and letting go is the only way forward. Number three, can we study Pali language on our own, or we need to attend classes since it is difficult to do alone? You can study Pali on your own if you wish, no problem, right? It depends how good you are with languages. If you are a language genius, then go ahead and start learning Pali on your own. If you're not a language genius, then there are tools available as well. I have taught Pali at Bodhidharma Monastery in many years. If you wish, you can fire off an email to me and I'll give you access to those talks if you wish. They're all available in the cloud. You just need to have the right access code to get in there. So you're more than welcome to do that if you wish. But for most lay people, learning Pali, unless you are very gifted with languages, may not really be necessary. Because the translations we have now of the suttas are quite good. It takes a lot of time to learn Pali. Sometimes it may be better to spend that time, going on retreats, doing the right things, and living a good life, rather than spending too much time on that. It can become sometimes a bit too intellectual. We become too bound in our heads. As a monk, it is very useful to learn Pali because we have more time and because you need to go deeper into the suttas as a monastic. Otherwise, you get invited to Thailand and you have nothing to say because you haven't actually studied anything, right? Oh, that is terrible. So you have to have something to say. So for me, it's good to know a bit of Pali. So then you when I say things, I sound really profound and wise, right? That is always very useful. So this is the thing, you never know whether it's a con game or whether it's a real thing. Yeah. You just, okay. Anyway, so, dear Ajahn, can we do away with a funeral that is black and white? White flowers and mourners in white and black. Can we have a funeral that celebrates the passing away with a good life, decorated with colorful flowers, no crying, and people, mourners, wearing colorful clothes, and eat and be merry? Do we need to invite the monks to chant at our funeral? Thank you. I think that's a wonderful idea. Why don't we kind of have some more colorful clothing and wear, you know, and have beautiful flowers and kind of play some nice pop music, I don't know, whatever it is. Of course we can do that. There's absolutely no reason why we can't do that. But you are kind of going in the face of tradition, right? The rest of your family may not be too pleased if you suggest that. They may say, what are you talking about? You heretic. I know Adam Ram always likes to go against the stream. He's really good at going against the stream with pretty much everything. And he tells jokes at funerals. I'm absolutely serious. He tells jokes at funerals. And it takes a certain kind of personality to be able to do that. You really have to feel really sure about yourself, and you have to have a certain charisma. But if you have that charisma and you feel sure about yourself, no problem. You can tell jokes at funerals. And everybody will laugh. That's the beautiful thing, right? So it actually does work. Do we have to mourn? Of course we don't have to mourn. We don't have to be sorrowful. It is about how we think about the situation that makes you sorrowful or not sorrowful. If you grieve, it's because you think about your loss. Oh no, my dear, something has passed away. I have lost something. It is because your focus is really a selfish way of looking at the world, right? What I have lost, that is what it is about. That's why you have grief. That's why you have sorrows and you mourn the passing away. But if instead you think, wow, actually, what a wonderful thing it was for me to have this relative for so long. What a great thing, how it enhanced my life. Whoa, you know, well done. Thank you for being with us for all of these years. Now I wish you happiness moving on into the future, right? That sort of attitude makes you feel much better. Also, another thing that you can think about is that sometimes, from a Buddhist point of view, when you pass away, then you get reborn again in the future. You might see them again in the future. Right? Sometimes these cutting off aren't as complete as we think they are. You may meet again in the future. So sometimes they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? So holiday is sometimes a good idea. Okay, so you go on, and then when you see them again, like a few years down the line, maybe it will be much happier circumstances because of that. So it's all about attitude, whether we, you know, and attitude is really the main issue here. But sometimes you get pulled along, everybody else is crying, right? So it's very hard to kind of resist the current, the stream of tears is hard to resist sometimes. So you get pulled along in the same way. But by all means, if you can persuade your relatives or whatever to have this kind of funeral, great. Do you have monks? Do you have to have monks to chant at the funeral? Certainly not. Don't have to have any monks there at all. Sometimes it can be nice to have a monastic or somebody or whoever to come and just say some nice words. But there should be good words, not words that make you cry and weep. But some good words that kind of encourages you, right? In the right practice and perhaps on the Buddhist path and that sort of thing. Yeah. So it's good. You're kind of thinking in the right way here. I think that's really, really good. Yes, sir.
There's one part of the question that says, monks
chanting,
does it help the dead?
Right. Oh, does it help the dead? Right. Do we need to invite monks to chant? Okay. It depends, right? I think that actually the chanting itself may not necessarily be all that powerful. The chanting is only one thing. But if you do the right thing at the funeral, if you give a nice talk, if you do some kind of forgiveness ceremony, right, or you send some metta to the person, that kind of thing. So for example, if you chant the Metta Sutta and you say to everybody, while we do this chanting, send some love to the person who's passed away. That kind of thing may have an effect. But just chanting for the sake of chanting may not actually be all that useful. Because the context, the whole thing, how it works together, that is important.
Okay. Dear Ajahn, in the morning talk, you talked about giving compassion to people and seeing the good in them. But I find a conflict within myself. I feel that I am patronizing them, and sometimes I'm very difficult to feel sincere about it. How to overcome this? Thank you very much. Okay. So, first of all, when you are compassionate, right, and you see the good in other people, many people have this kind of feeling. You're not the first person who mentions this. But remember that it doesn't make you kind of better or higher just because you have compassion for them. If you regard them as deluded, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are all that wise. But right now, in this context, you have a little bit of wisdom and they don't, right? Next year, it might be the other way around. You might be down in the dumps and really deluded, and they are the wise person. So these things are always changing, and because they're always changing, these are not permanent aspects of our personality. You should never feel pride or feel that you are better just because you have compassion for somebody else and you see them in a certain way. Yeah? Next time it is your turn to be in a difficult situation, they will have compassion for you. And then you should be grateful that somebody actually has compassion for you. Yeah? So this is the way to overcome that, to remember that these are not permanent aspects of us. They are fluctuating things that come and go. And then you become much more humble about your wisdom. Yes, so that humility is a very important part of this. Okay, so yeah, don't be patronizing, that's not very nice, right? So try that and see what happens. If it doesn't work, then tackle it when it doesn't work. Yeah. How do you know that what you see, feel, think is real, true, versus fabrication of your deluded mind? That is, what and how is the discerning process, given that meditation is a process of unfolding purification into truth, and we can't completely see all everything clearly yet because we're not arahants. Okay, that's a very good question. How do you know that your experiences are real, right? Is this the real deal, or is it just a fabrication of the mind? And one of the basic ways of going about knowing what is delusion and what is not is to know the clarity you have in your mind. The more defilements are there, the more deluded you are. So trust your mind only when the mind is clear. When the defilements are kind of low, you don't have any strong desires, you feel quite peaceful, and you don't have any anger or ill will or any of these things, that is when the mind is most reliable. And sometimes people ask about intuition. Is intuition, is that a tool on the Buddhist path? And again, it's exactly the same thing. Your intuition tends to be right when the mind is pure. When you feel calm, relaxed, and at ease, that is when the intuition usually works. If your mind is in turmoil, there's all kinds of things happening, your intuition is going to be very bad. Don't trust your intuition in that kind of circumstance. So this is how you have some idea whether there is delusion or not going on. And as you move on this path, the further down the track you go, the less defilements you have, the more clear it is what you're seeing, the more obvious it's going to be that that is actually the truth. And you will see this as you move along the path, as you're reducing your defilements. So for example, if you talk about the thinking mind, right? Because the thinking mind is one of those things, well, how much of what we think is actually true? Well, usually the reason why we think in the first place is because there's some defilements going on, right? Thinking is often driven by craving, it's driven by ill will, it's driven by delusion. So because of that, the vast majority of our thinking is going to be deluded, at least to some extent. Remember, delusion is a matter of degree, right? The thinking may be true to some extent, but then there's some kind of delusion coming in there. So it is deluded and true at the same time. But what you want to do is have thinking which is absolutely true with all the delusion taken out. That is actually where you want to go. Yeah? So be skeptical about your thinking mind because it is highly uncertain. So it is a gradual emergence of truth. As you walk along the path, the truth comes out gradually. Things become more and more clear to you. And this gradual emergence of truth is part of this the path of Buddhism. And eventually you come to a point when you become very, very peaceful. Mind is very, very clear and bright. And that is when you can have real insights into reality. Yes, there's some pointers on how to go about that. Okay, why are sensual pleasures not supportive of the meditative path? What about the pleasures and luxuries of this hotel? Oh, that is a very embarrassing question now. You really... Well, it depends how you use them, right? For most people, we live in the sensual realm, and this kind of hotel, yes, it's true, but, you know, for most people, this is kind of, it is luxurious, but it's not kind of completely out of the kind of the ordinary. A lot of people stay in these kind of hotels, and this is, in a sense, part and parcel of life. How do you deal with it, right? This is kind of more important. Do you deal with the sensual pleasures here in a good way? After all, most of you are coming here to meditate, right? I see you here every day. You come here to listen to Dhamma discourses. That is actually quite a good way of dealing with these luxuries. We're not just indulging all the time, right? So it's not such a bad thing here. So I don't think that this is necessarily going to hinder you all that much in your practice. So what we have to do is that we have to remember again that the abandoning of sensual pleasures, like so many things, is a very gradual thing. And the most important thing in the abandoning of sensual pleasures is to keep the five precepts. Why? This is number one. If you can keep the five precepts, you have already abandoned some pleasures. There are certain pleasures you cannot indulge in. And those are kind of, that is the baseline. That is the most important thing. Now, beyond that, the most important thing to abandon is not sensual pleasures, but anger and ill will. That is far more of a problem than sensuality. It leads to much worse results. Sensuality is, after all, it's just a bit of fun, just a bit of enjoying yourself. It may not lead to deep meditation, but it's not something very harmful. Whereas anger obviously leads to a lot of harm and a lot of problems. So sensuality is a very gradual thing to overcome. One of the great ways of overcoming this, I will talk a bit about that tomorrow, is to understand it in the context of the bigger picture, right? And then when you see it in the context of a bigger picture, you can start to understand the limitations of this. So you don't take these things too seriously. You find the nice middle way, you do it in the right way, and you'll be fine. Don't worry too much about the sensuality. Deal mostly with the anger and that kind of stuff. Of course, the problem is, the reality is that where there is sensuality, there will also tend to be conflict and anger. The two are actually related to each other. So in the end, if you want to overcome ill will completely, you actually have to overcome sensuality as well, because they are related to each other. But still, you can overcome a lot of ill will without dealing with sensuality. Okay, when I am meditating or reading Dhamma books, I feel heat, energy around my chest or on top of my head. What is that? Okay, so I don't know what it is, no idea. So you have some energy and things happening in the upper part of your body. I don't know. So it's not, you know, the point here is that these kind of sensations that we have, they are neither good nor bad in their own right. These are just feelings. And people often have all kinds of strange feelings happening in a meditation practice. And that is not an issue. What is an issue is what your mind is doing here. So if your mind is nice and balanced, if you are enjoying the meditation, if you are enjoying reading the Dhamma book, then there is no problem whatsoever. And maybe it is a good sign, right? Maybe something is being released inside of you. Maybe it's a positive sign that you're kind of healing up or something like that. It's very hard to know what is going on.
But the main thing is the state of your mind. If your state of the mind is in the right place, then you are fine. If you're getting very confused and angry in your meditation, then of course there is a problem. And if the heat comes from that, then it is not so good. Okay, is there collective karma? Is Donald Trump the collective karma of the U.S.? If I help someone who later does bad, do I share his or her karma? Okay. In Buddhism, there is no collective karma. All karma is individual, right? You do something and you reap the results of that karma. It's an individual thing. Collective karma is because it's all about intention, right? We don't have collective intentions. We have individual intentions. We may have the same intention, but that's just individually having the same intention. We don't actually have collective intentions as such. So because of that, all karma is individual. Is Donald Trump the collective karma of the U.S.? Well, not really. He is just the result of all the forces in the world working in a certain way, and then Donald Trump becomes president, right? That's what's happening. So, it's interesting. You have to be very careful what you say as a monk, because there are not Buddhists out there who are very supportive of Donald Trump, right? And they too have to be part of our Buddhist society. We can't just kick them out just because they support Donald Trump. There might be good-hearted people and kind people regardless. People have all kinds of reasons for supporting somebody like that. So as a monk, you have to be welcoming to everyone. So whatever my private views are, that's a different matter. But you have to be a bit sensitive to these things. If I help someone who later does bad, do I share his or her karma? No, you never share somebody's karma unless, what matters here is your intention, right? So if you help the other person purely out of compassion, purely because of the goodness of your heart, all you are doing is creating good karma. But if you think, if I help this person, they will do bad later on, and I want them to do bad later on, then of course, it's a bit more dodgy, right? So if you think, this person, they are going to kill somebody else, and I will, because I don't really like that person, I will help them just a little bit, right? I will maybe find a nice gun for them or something like that. That's obviously where you make bad karma. So, but all you have to do, and this is what makes it so easy to know if you're making good or bad karma, because all you have to do is look into your heart and ask yourself, where are you coming from? What is your motivation? That's all you ever have to know. And if you know that your motivation is pure, you are fine. Okay, Iradan, thank you for sharing your monastic journey last night. I find it inspiring. I find myself contemplating a monastic life the more I get exposed to the Dhamma. Do you have any advice for me? That's wonderful to hear that. I'm very happy that you are contemplating monastic life. To me, monastic life is really now. It's pretty much the only thing I want to do. I can't really imagine doing anything else. It's a very meaningful life. You really feel that you are living a life which has absolutely packed with meaning. You are doing something which advances you to the maximum on the spiritual path. You're able to help other people at the same time, right? Everything I do, every act I do, I feel is meaningful. It is not just empty silliness. Well, sometimes I'm stupid like everybody else, but generally speaking, as long as I remember the Eightfold Path and practice the right way, almost everything I do is meaningful. It's a wonderful thing, because a lot of people find that their life is kind of empty, meaningless, right? Just wandering around in this desert of sensual pleasures, enjoying this, enjoying that, not actually going anywhere. And what a wonderful thing it is to have a really life that is really, really meaningful. It's very powerful and very beautiful. So I would, what I would recommend you to do, if you're interested in this, is to check it out. Come and stay at the monastery for a while, first of all, and you may find it's absolutely terrible. You never want to do it ever again, right? Okay, so that's it. That means you're done with that. But otherwise, you may enjoy it, right? Maybe you like that. And gradually, gradually, you take yourself in that direction. So please come down and stay at Bodhidharma Monastery for a while. We have quite an international community there. I really like international, multicultural communities. I really enjoy that because it has diversity and you know, people have different views. And it's a great way of becoming very, very open-minded, right, about people and very kind of accepting of different ways, a different way of doing things. So I love that diversity, and it would be great if we had even more diversity in our monastery. It's a bit too kind of European right now. It would be great if we had more Asian monastics down there. We have one very nice Asian man now who's in Malaysian, and he's hopefully going to become a monk very soon, and we have more on the waiting list. So hopefully we'll have more Asian monks also in our monastery in the future. That would be very, very inspiring, very good. Some of the Asian monks we have, they're kind of half Aussie, half Asian, not the real deal, right? Okay, next one. Dear Ajahn, I was an atheist in my younger days, only turned to Buddhism in my early 40s. I'm convinced I should carry on along this path. Hooray! Wonderful! Okay. Just like me, I was also pretty much an atheist before. I didn't really believe in anything. And I'm still a bit of an atheist, actually. But I'm also a Buddhist. I don't think there is any great conflict between atheism and Buddhism, really. At least to some extent. How can I ensure that my future self will continue on this path if I'm reborn as a human being? Thank you. There is a drawing of a cat at the bottom. Okay, that's very nice. Okay. So how can I ensure that I will continue on this path? I actually did answer this question a couple of days ago. Maybe you are one of the newbies who just come here. And the answer to that question is, first of all, understand the Buddha's teachings really well. Because whenever you get reborn in the future, it is like the most likely Buddhist teaching that you will come across are the real core teachings of the Buddha. You know, they say in one of the suttas, if you get reborn in the heavenly realm, straight away, you're not sure what is going on. And then you hear some of the devas kind of talking about Dhamma, and you listen, wow, I know this stuff, right? I remember this stuff. And then your memory re-arises as a deva, and you are recalling those teachings again. And it's similar, I think, as a human being as well. We have no direct recollection of our past lives, but somewhere in our heart, something is lodged there. There will still be some kind of feeling of, not a direct recollection of these things, but a feeling that this is me, this is right. Somehow you know this. I think this is what happened to me to a very large extent. So know those suttas. Be careful here, because too many Buddhists around the world, all they ever listen to are the Dhamma talks from this teacher, that teacher, and they're often very idiosyncratic. They are not the core Buddhist teachings. It's fine, of course, to listen to those teachings, but make sure you take enough time to also understand the really core teachings of what the Buddha himself taught, because then you will have the real teachings, and you will recognize it much more easily when you get reborn. This is one part of it. The other part is to practice to the best of your ability, so that when you, in the next time, you start as a high as possible, high level as possible, that means you have internalized more Dhamma, and you're also further along the path, which makes it easier for you to continue along the same path as a consequence. The further you go along the Buddhist path in this life, the purer your conduct is and mind is, the more powerful will the message of the Buddha will be on your mind, and it will sink deeper into you. Right? So they go together, these things, the purity of your mind and your ability to fully appreciate the teachings. And don't worry too much if you are an atheist, because I think that's quite a good place to come from, right? You're coming from a sense, okay, well, you're kind of stepping out of all the religious stuff, and just looking at it, and it's not a bad place to start and then move on to something which actually makes good sense, like the Buddhist teachings. Okay, I'm going a little bit over time, but there's only two more questions left, so we'll do those as well. How do you know that your karma with a person is finished completely? That is, how do you know that you don't need to continue to have a special relationship with this person? We don't have karma with people, right? This is one of those other Buddhist myths that go along. You should listen to a workshop that I did with Ajahn Sujata a few years ago. It was called Karma and Rebirth in Early Buddhism. It's available on the internet. We did workshops over 6 workshops, whole day workshops, just on karma and rebirth. And the very first workshop was called Myth Busting, right? The catchy title, right? Myth Busting. So we started off busting all these myths. And this is one myth, I think we forgot to bust this one. This is one of those myths that we should have busted, that you make karma with people. You don't actually make karma with people. What you do is you attach to people. And that attachment then leads you to hang out with them in the future. So what we should really do is we should ask ourselves, you know, attachments are natural in human beings. You cannot avoid some degree of attachment. Why is that? It's because you have a sense of self. As long as there is a sense of self, a degree of attachment will also be there. So what we need to do sometimes is to ask ourselves, what are the attachments that are most useful for me right in this life? So you're attached in places that are useful, that kind of bring you forward a little bit on the path. You're going to have attachments anyway, so attach to the right people. So if you are looking for a partner in life, find somebody who is compatible with you, right? Somebody who thinks roughly the same way, so you can support each other on the Buddhist path. That is often very useful. Regarding the precepts, attach a little bit to the precepts. So if you don't attach at all, you're not going to keep them. So a little bit of attachment is good. Attach to the idea of being good, right? Or being kind. Because when you attach a little bit to that, you're more likely to be good and kind. Don't think that you can do these things without any attachments at all. It is virtually impossible. So this is what is going on here. So when you're talking about karma, you're talking about attachment to that other person. And that attachment that you have, maybe sometimes it can be negative attachment, you're really averse to them as a kind of negative attachment, or positive attachment. So as you practice the path, gradually you transcend the attachment, you go beyond it. Attachments decrease as you move along this path, and as they decrease, you become more independent and more free as a person. And that is how that special relationship eventually kind of resolves, right? The person you should be most attached to of all, you know what that is? It's the Buddha, right? So be attached to the Buddha. That is really useful, because then it will go a long way on the path. Okay, last question for tonight. Can some people see ghosts and other beings? Does that mean they are more advanced in meditation if they see ghosts? Depends, right? It depends if you enjoy seeing the ghosts or not. If you don't enjoy it, it's not so advanced, right? Oh, I have to see all these ghosts. I don't really want to see them. So, yes, some people can see them. Sometimes it does not necessarily mean that they are more advanced. They may just have some residual karma, residual development from a past life that is still hanging in there, and they can see these things. Some people are more kind of visual by nature, and they might see things. Sometimes they don't actually see anything at all, it's just made up in their minds, and they think they are seeing ghosts, right? That's another possibility. So it really depends. But of course, if you do get very good meditation, then often you will be able to access these things, and you may very well be able to see ghosts as a consequence. So it can be the result of a good meditation, but not necessarily so. There you are. But it's cool to see ghosts, right? Don't be afraid of that. It's a nice thing to do. You can actually get access to a larger reality. I know some people who have seen ghosts, they are so happy about that, because it has given them a feeling that the world is actually much more to the world than quite literally meets the eye. right? There's actually more to the world. And that kind of offers up new possibilities for them, and it makes them more, perhaps more spiritual, more better at practicing kindness in this world. And if seeing ghosts makes you a better person, then wow, then it's very powerful. Okay, enough for tonight then. So have a nice night, have a nice rest, and let's pay homage to the Dhamma Sangha.